In defense of children. My colleague, the psychologist Nicholas Humphrey, used the sticks and stones proverb in introducing his amnesty lecture in Oxford in 1997. Humphrey began his lecture by arguing that the proverb is not always true, citing the case of Haitian voodoo believers who die, apparently from some psychosomatic effect of terror, within days of having a malign spell cast upon them. He then asked whether Amnesty International, the beneficiary of the lecture series to which he was contributing, should campaign against hurtful or damaging speeches or publications. His answer was a resounding no to such censorship in general.
Freedom of speech is too precious a freedom to be meddled with.
But he then went on to shock his liberal self by advocating one important exception, to argue in favour of censorship for the special case of children.
Moral and religious education, and especially the education a child receives at home, where parents are allowed, even expected, to determine for their children what counts as truth and falsehood, right and wrong. Children, I'll argue, have a human right not to have their minds crippled by exposure to other people's bad ideas, no matter who these other people are. Parents, correspondingly, have no God-given license to enculturate their children in whatever ways they personally choose. No right to limit the horizons of their children's knowledge, to bring them up in an atmosphere of dogma and superstition, or to insist they follow the straight and narrow paths of their own faith. In short, children have a right not to have their minds addled by nonsense, and we as a society have a duty to protect them from it. So we should no more allow parents to teach their children to believe, for example, in the literal truth of the Bible, or that the planets rule their lives, than we should allow parents to knock their children's teeth out or lock them in a dungeon.
Of course, such a strong statement needs, and received, much qualification. Isn't it a matter of opinion what is nonsense? Hasn't the apple cart of orthodox science been upset often enough to chasten us into caution? Scientists may think it is nonsense to teach astrology and the literal truth of the Bible, but there are others who think the opposite, and aren't they entitled to teach it to their children? Isn't it just as arrogant to insist that children should be taught science? I thank my own parents for taking the view that children should be taught not so much what to think as how to think. If, having been fairly and properly exposed to all the scientific evidence, they grow up and decide that the Bible is literally true, or that the movements of the planets rule their lives, that is their privilege. The important point is that it is their privilege to decide what they shall think, and not their parents' privilege to impose it by force majeure. And this, of course, is especially important when we reflect that children become the parents of the next generation in a position to pass on whatever indoctrination may have moulded them. Humphrey suggests that, as long as children are young, vulnerable, and in need of protection, truly moral guardianship shows itself in an honest attempt to second-guess what they would choose for themselves if they were old enough to do so. He movingly quotes the example of a young Inca girl whose 500-year-old remains were found frozen in the mountains of Peru in 1995. The anthropologist who discovered her wrote that she had been the victim of a ritual sacrifice. By Humphrey's account, a documentary film about this young ice maiden was shown on American television. Viewers were invited
to marvel at the spiritual commitment of the Inca priests and to share with the girl on her last journey her pride and excitement at having been selected for the signal honor of being sacrificed. The message of the television program was, in effect, that the practice of human sacrifice was, in its own way, a glorious cultural invention, another jewel in the crown of multiculturalism, if you like.
Humphrey is scandalized, and so am I.
Yet how dare anyone even suggest this? How dare they invite us in our sitting rooms watching television to feel uplifted by contemplating an act of ritual murder, the murder of a dependent child by a group of stupid, puffed-up, superstitious, ignorant old men? How dare they invite us to find good for ourselves in contemplating an immoral action against someone else?
Again, the decent liberal reader may feel a twinge of unease. Immoral by our standards, certainly, and stupid. But what about Inca standards? Surely to the Incas, the sacrifice was a moral act, and far from stupid, sanctioned by all that they held sacred. The little girl was no doubt a loyal believer in the religion in which she was brought up. Who are we to use a word like murder, judging Inca priests by our own standards rather than theirs? Perhaps this girl was rapturously happy with her fate. Perhaps she really believed she was going straight to everlasting paradise, warmed by the radiant company of the sun god. Or perhaps, as seems far more likely, she screamed in terror. Humphrey's point, and mine, is that regardless of whether she was a willing victim or not, there is strong reason to suppose that she would not have been willing if she had been in full possession of the facts. For example, suppose she had known that the sun is really a ball of hydrogen, hotter than 1,000,000 degrees Kelvin, converting itself into helium by nuclear fusion, and that it originally formed from a disk of gas out of which the rest of the solar system, including Earth, also condensed. Presumably then, she would not have worshipped it as a god, and this would have altered her perspective on being sacrificed to propitiate it.
The Inca priests cannot be blamed for their ignorance, and it could perhaps be thought harsh to judge them stupid and puffed up. But they can be blamed for foisting their own beliefs on a child too young to decide whether to worship the sun or not. Humphrey's additional point is that today's documentary filmmakers and we, their audience, can be blamed for seeing beauty in that little girl's death, something that enriches our collective culture. The same tendency to glory in the quaintness of ethnic religious habits and to justify cruelties in their name crops up again and again. It is the source of squirming internal conflict in the minds of nice liberal people who, on the one hand, cannot bear suffering and cruelty, but on the other hand have been trained by postmodernists and relativists to respect other cultures no less than their own. Female circumcision is undoubtedly hideously painful. It sabotages sexual pleasure in women, indeed this is probably its underlying purpose, and one half of the decent liberal mind wants to abolish the practice. The other half, however, respects ethnic cultures and feels that we should not interfere if they want to mutilate their girls. Point, of course, is that their girls are actually the girls' own girls, and their wishes should not be ignored. Trickier to answer, what if a girl says she wants to be circumcised? But would she, with the hindsight of a fully informed adult, wish that it had never happened? Humphrey makes the point that no adult woman who has somehow missed out on circumcision as a child volunteers for the operation later in life. It is a regular practice in Britain today. A senior schools inspector tells of London girls in 2006 being sent to an uncle in Bradford to be circumcised. Authorities turn a blind eye for fear of being thought racist in the community.
After a discussion of the Amish and their right to bring up their own children in their own way, Humphrey is scathing about our enthusiasm as a society for
maintaining cultural diversity. All right, you may want to say, so it's tough on a child of the Amish or the Hasidim or the Gypsies to be shaped up by their parents in the ways they are. But at least the result is that these fascinating cultural traditions continue. Would not our whole civilization be impoverished if they were to go? It's a shame, maybe, when individuals have to be sacrificed to maintain such diversity, but there it is. It's the price we pay as a society. Except I would feel bound to remind you, we do not pay it. They do.
The issue came to public attention in 1972 when the US Supreme Court ruled on a test case, Wisconsin versus Yoda, which concerned the right of parents to withdraw their children from school on religious grounds. The Amish people live in closed communities in various parts of the United States, mostly speaking an archaic dialect of German called Pennsylvania Dutch, and eschewing, to various extents, electricity, internal combustion engines, buttons, and other manifestations of modern life. There is indeed something attractively quaint about an island of 17th century life as a spectacle for today's eyes. Isn't it worth preserving for the sake of the enrichment of human diversity? And the only way to preserve it is to allow the Amish to educate their own children in their own way and to protect them from the corrupting influence of modernity. But, we surely want to ask, shouldn't the children themselves have some say in the matter?
The Supreme Court was asked to rule in 1972 when some Amish parents in Wisconsin withdrew their children from high school. The very idea of education beyond a certain age was contrary to Amish religious values, and scientific education especially so. The state of Wisconsin took the parents to court, claiming that the children were being deprived of their right to an education. After passing up through the courts, the case eventually reached the United States Supreme Court, which handed down a split, 6-1 decision, in favor of the parents. The majority opinion, written by Chief Justice Warren Burger, included the following.
As the record shows, compulsory school attendance to age 16 for Amish children carries with it a very real threat of undermining the Amish community and religious practice as they exist today. They must either abandon belief and be assimilated into society at large, or be forced to migrate to some other and more tolerant region.
Justice William O. Douglas's minority opinion was that the children themselves should have been consulted. Did they really want to cut short their education? Did they indeed really want to stay in the Amish religion? Nicholas Humphrey would have gone further. Even if the children had been asked and had expressed a preference for the Amish religion, can we suppose that they would have done so if they'd been educated and informed about the available alternatives? For this to be plausible, shouldn't there be examples of young people from the outside world voting with their feet and volunteering to join the Amish? Justice Douglas went further in a slightly different direction. He saw no particular reason to give the religious views of parents special status in deciding how far they should be allowed to deprive their children of education. If religion is grounds for exemption, might there not be secular beliefs that also qualify? The majority of the Supreme Court drew a parallel with some of the positive values of monastic orders, whose presence in our society arguably enriches it. But as Humphrey points out, there is a crucial difference. Monks volunteer for the monastic life of their own free will. Amish children never volunteered to be Amish. They were born into it, and they had no choice.
There is something breathtakingly condescending, as well as inhumane, about the sacrificing of anyone, especially children, on the altar of diversity and the virtue of preserving a variety of religious traditions. The rest of us are happy with our cars and computers, our vaccines and antibiotics, but you quaint little people with your bonnets and breeches, your horse buggies, your archaic dialect and your earth closet privies, you enrich our lives. Of course you must be allowed to trap your children with you in your 17th century time warp. Otherwise something irretrievable would be lost to us, a part of the wonderful diversity of human culture. A small part of me can see something in this, but the larger part is made to feel very queasy indeed. An educational scandal. The Prime Minister of my country, Tony Blair, invoked diversity when challenged in the House of Commons by Jenny Tong, MP, to justify government subsidy of a school in the northeast of England that, almost uniquely in Britain, teaches literal biblical creationism. Mr. Blair replied that it would be unfortunate if concerns about that issue were to interfere with our getting as diverse a school system as we properly can. The school in question, Emmanuel College in Gateshead, is one of the city academies set up in a proud initiative of the Blair government. Rich benefactors are encouraged to put up a relatively small sum of money, £2 million in the case of Emmanuel, which buys a much larger sum of government money, £20 million for this school, plus running costs and salaries in perpetuity, and also buys the benefactor the right to control the ethos of the school, the appointment of a majority of the school governors, the policy for exclusion or inclusion of pupils, and much else. Emmanuel's 10% benefactor is Sir Peter Vardy, a wealthy car salesman with a creditable desire to give today's children the education he wishes he had had, and a less creditable desire to imprint his own personal religious convictions upon them. H.L. Mencken was prophetic when he wrote,
"Deep within the heart of every evangelist lies the wreck of a car salesman."
Vardy has unfortunately become embroiled with a clique of American-inspired fundamentalist teachers led by Nigel McCoyd, sometime headmaster of Emmanuel and now director of a whole consortium of Vardy schools. The level of McCoyd's scientific understanding can be judged from his belief that the world is less than 10,000 years old, and also from the following quotation.
"But to think that we just evolved from a bang That we used to be monkeys? That seems unbelievable when you look at the complexity of the human body. If you tell children there is no purpose to their life, that they are just a chemical mutation, that doesn't build self-esteem.
No scientist has ever suggested that a child is a chemical mutation. The use of the phrase in such a context is illiterate nonsense, on a par with the declarations of Bishop Wayne Malcolm, leader of the Christian Life City Church in Hackney, East London, who, according to The Guardian of 18th of April 2006, disputes the scientific evidence for evolution. Malcolm's understanding of the evidence he disputes can be gauged from his statement that
there is clearly an absence in the fossil record for intermediate levels of development. If a frog turned into a monkey, well, shouldn't you have lots of fronkies?
Well, science is not Mr. McCoy's subject either, so we should, in fairness, turn to his head of science, Stephen Layfield, instead. On 21st of September 2001, Mr. Layfield gave a lecture at Emmanuel College on The Teaching of Science, A Biblical Perspective. The text of the lecture was posted on a Christian website, but you won't find it there now. The Christian Institute removed the lecture the very day after I had called attention to it in an article in the Daily Telegraph on 18th of March 2002, where I subjected it to a critical dissection. It is hard, however, to delete something permanently from the World Wide Web. Search engines achieve their speed partly by keeping caches of information, and these inevitably persist for a while even after the originals have been deleted. An alert British journalist, Andrew Brown, the Independent's first religious affairs correspondent, promptly located the Layfield lecture, downloaded it from the Google cache, and posted it, safe from deletion, on his own website. Incidentally, when a curious reader wrote to Emmanuel College to ask why the lecture had been removed from the website, he received the following disingenuous reply from the school, again recorded by Andrew Brown.
Emmanuel College has been at the centre of a debate regarding the teaching of creation in schools. At a practical level, Emmanuel College has had a huge number of press calls. This has involved a considerable amount of time for the principal and senior directors of the college. All of these people have other jobs to do. In order to assist, we have temporarily removed a lecture by Stephen Layfield from our website.
Of course, the school officials may well have been too busy to explain to journalists their stance on teaching creationism. But why then remove from their website the text of a lecture that does precisely that, and to which they could have referred the journalists, thereby saving themselves a great deal of time? No, they removed their head of science's lecture because they recognised that they had something to hide. The following paragraph is from the beginning of his lecture.
Let us state, then, right from the start, that we reject the notion popularised, perhaps inadvertently, by Francis Bacon in the 17th century, that there are two books, i.e. the Book of Nature and the Scriptures, which may be mined independently for truth. Rather, we stand firm upon the bare proposition that God has spoken authoritatively and inerrantly in the pages of Holy Scripture. However fragile, old-fashioned, or naive this assertion may ostensibly appear, especially to an unbelieving, TV-drunk modern culture, we can be sure that it is as robust a foundation as it is possible to lay down and build upon.
You have to keep pinching yourself. You're not dreaming. This is not some preacher in a tent in Alabama, but the head of science at a school into which the British government is pouring money and which is Tony Blair's pride and joy. A devout Christian himself, Mr. Blair in 2004, performed the ceremonial opening of one of the later additions to the Vardy fleet of schools. Diversity may be a virtue, but this is diversity gone mad. Layfield proceeds to itemise the comparison between science and scripture, concluding in every case where there seems to be a conflict, that scripture is to be preferred. Noting that earth science is now included in the national curriculum, Layfield says,
it would seem particularly prudent for all those who deliver this aspect of the course to familiarise themselves with the flood geology papers of Whitcomb and Morris.
Yes, flood geology means what you think it means. We're talking Noah's Ark here. Noah's Ark. When the children could be learning the spine-tingling fact that Africa and South America were once joined and have drawn apart at the speed with which fingernails grow. Here's more from Layfield, the head of science, on Noah's flood as the recent and rapid explanation for phenomena which, according to real geological evidence, took hundreds of millions of years to grind out.
We must acknowledge within our grand geophysical paradigm the historicity of a worldwide flood as outlined in Genesis 6 to 10. If the biblical narrative is secure and the listed genealogies, e.g. Genesis 5, 1 Chronicles 1, Matthew 1 and Luke 3, are substantially full, we must reckon that this global catastrophe took place in the relatively recent past. Its effects are everywhere abundantly apparent. Principal evidence is found in the fossil-laden sedimentary rocks, the extensive reserves of hydrocarbon fuels, coal, oil and gas, and the legendary accounts of just such a great flood common to various population groups worldwide. The feasibility of maintaining an ark full of representative creatures for a year until the waters had sufficiently receded has been well documented by, among others, John Woodmorap.
In a way, this is even worse than the utterances of know-nothings like Nigel McQuoid or Bishop Wayne Malcolm quoted above, because Layfield is educated in science. Here's another astonishing passage.
As we stated at the beginning, Christians, with very good reason, reckon the scriptures of the Old and New Testaments a reliable guide concerning just what we are to believe. They're not merely religious documents. They provide us with a true account of earth history, which we ignore at our peril.
The implication that the scriptures provide a literal account of geological history would make any reputable theologian wince. My friend Richard Harris, Bishop of Oxford, and I wrote a joint letter to Tony Blair, and we got it signed by 8 bishops and 9 senior scientists. The 9 scientists included the then president of the Royal Society, previously Tony Blair's chief scientific adviser, both the biological and physical secretaries of the Royal Society, the Astronomer Royal, now President of the Royal Society, the Director of the Natural History Museum, and Sir David Attenborough, perhaps the most respected man in England. The bishops included 1 Roman Catholic and 7 Anglican bishops, senior religious leaders from all around England. We received a perfunctory and inadequate reply from the Prime Minister's office referring to the school's good examination results and its good report from the official school's inspection agency, Ofsted. It apparently didn't occur to Mr. Blair that if the Ofsted inspectors give a rave report to a school whose head of science teaches that the entire universe began after the domestication of the dog, there just might be something a teeny-weeny bit wrong with the standards of the inspectorate. Perhaps the most disturbing section of Stephen Layfield's lecture is his concluding What Can Be Done, where he considers the tactics to be employed by those teachers wishing to introduce fundamentalist Christianity into the science classroom. For example, he urges science teachers to
note every occasion when an evolutionary old earth paradigm, millions or billions of years, is explicitly mentioned or implied by a textbook, examination question or visitor, and courteously point out the fallibility of the statement. Wherever possible, we must give the alternative, always better, biblical explanation of the same data. We shall look at a few examples from each of physics, chemistry and biology in due course.
The rest of Layfield's lecture is nothing less than a propaganda manual, a resource for religious teachers of biology, chemistry and physics who wish, while remaining just inside the guidelines of the national curriculum, to subvert evidence-based science education and replace it with biblical scripture. On 15th of April 2006, James Naughtie, one of the BBC's most experienced anchormen, interviewed Sir Peter Vardy on radio. The main subject of the interview was a police investigation of allegations, denied by Vardy, that bribes, knighthoods and peerages, had been offered by the Blair government to rich men in an attempt to get them to subscribe to the City Academy scheme. Naughtie also asked Vardy about the creationism issue, and Vardy categorically denied that Emmanuel promotes young earth creationism to its pupils. One of Emmanuel's alumni, Peter French, has equally categorically stated,
"We were taught that the earth was 6,000 years old."
To get an idea of the scale of this error, it is equivalent to believing that the distance from New York to San Francisco is 700 yards. Who is telling the truth here? Well, we don't know. but Stephen Layfield's lecture lays out his policy for teaching science pretty candidly. Has Vardy never read Layfield's very explicit manifesto? Does he really not know what his head of science has been up to? Peter Vardy made his money selling used cars. Would you buy one from him? And would you, like Tony Blair, sell him a school for 10% of its price, throwing in an offer to pay all his running costs into the bargain? Let's be charitable to Blair and assume that he, at least, has not read the Layfield lecture. I suppose it is too much to hope that his attention may now be drawn to it. Headmaster McCoyd offered a defence of what he clearly saw as his school's open-mindedness, which is remarkable for its patronising complacency.
The best example I can give of what it is like here is a sixth-form philosophy lecture I was giving. Shaquille was sitting there, and he says, "The Quran is correct and true," and Claire over here says, "No, the Bible is true." So we talked about the similarities between what they say and the places where they disagree, and we agreed that they could not both be true. And eventually I said, "Sorry, Shaquille, you are wrong. It is the Bible that is true." And he said, "Sorry, Mr. McCoyd, you are wrong. It is the Quran." And they went on to lunch and carried on discussing it there. That's what we want. We want children to know why it is they believe what they believe and to defend it.
What a charming picture. Shaquille and Claire went to lunch together, vigorously arguing their cases and defending their incompatible beliefs. But is it really so charming? Isn't it actually rather a deplorable picture that Mr. McCoyd has painted? Upon what, after all, did Shaquille and Claire base their argument? What cogent evidence was each one able to bring to bear in their vigorous and constructive debate? Claire and Shaquille each simply asserted that her or his holy book was superior, and that was that. That is apparently all they said, and that indeed is all you can say when you have been taught that truth comes from scripture rather than from evidence. Claire and Shaquille and their fellows were not being educated. They were being let down by their school, and their school principal was abusing not their bodies, but their minds.
Consciousness raising again. And now here's another charming picture. At Christmas time one year, the daily newspaper The Independent was looking for a seasonal image and found a heartwarmingly ecumenical one at a school nativity play. The three wise men were played by, as the caption glowingly said, Shadbreet, a Sikh, Musharraf, a Muslim, and Adele, a Christian, all aged 4.
Charming. Heartwarming. No, it is not. It is neither. It is grotesque. How could any decent person think it right to label 4-year-old children with the cosmic and theological opinions of their parents? To see this, imagine an identical photograph with the caption changed as follows.
Shadbreet, a Keynesian, Musharraf, a monetarist, and Adele, a Marxist. All aged 4.
Wouldn't this be a candidate for irate letters of protest? It certainly should be. Yet, because of the weirdly privileged status of religion, not a squeak was heard, nor is it ever heard on any similar occasion. Just imagine the outcry if the caption had read,
Shadbreet, an atheist, Musharraf, an agnostic, and Adele, a secular humanist. All aged 4.
Mightn't the parents actually be investigated to see if they were fit to bring up children? In Britain, where we lack a constitutional separation between church and state, atheist parents usually go with the flow and let schools teach their children whatever religion prevails in the culture. The Brights.net, an American initiative to rebrand atheists as Brights in the same way as homosexuals successfully rebranded themselves as gays, is scrupulous in setting out the rules for children to sign up.
The decision to be a Bright must be the child's. Any youngster who is told he or she must or should be a Bright cannot be a Bright.
Can you even begin to imagine a church or mosque issuing such a self-denying ordinance? But shouldn't they be compelled to do so? Incidentally, I signed up to the Brights partly because I was genuinely curious whether such a word could be mimetically engineered into the language. I don't know, and would like to, whether the transmutation of gay was deliberately engineered or whether it just happened. The Brights campaign got off to a shaky start when it was furiously denounced by some atheists, petrified of being branded arrogant. The gay pride movement, fortunately, suffers from no such false modesty, which may be why it succeeded. In an earlier chapter, I generalize the theme of consciousness raising, starting with the achievement of feminists in making us flinch when we hear a phrase like men of goodwill instead of people of goodwill. Here I want to raise consciousness in another way. I think we should all wince when we hear a small child being labelled as belonging to some particular religion or another. Small children are too young to decide their views on the origins of the cosmos, of life, and of morals. The very sound of the phrase Christian child or Muslim child should grate like fingernails on a blackboard. Here is a report dated 3rd of September 2001 from the Irish radio station KPFT-FM.
Catholic schoolgirls faced protests from loyalists as they attempted to enter the Holy Cross Girls' Primary School on the Ardoyne Road in North Belfast. Royal Ulster Constabulary, RUC, officers and British Army, BA, soldiers had to clear the protesters who were attempting to blockade the school. Crash barriers were erected to allow the children to get through the protest to the school. Loyalists jeered and shouted sectarian abuse as the children, some as young as 4 years of age, were escorted by the parents into the school. As children and parents entered the front gate of the school, loyalists threw bottles and stones.
Naturally, any decent person will wince at the ordeal of these unfortunate schoolgirls. I am trying to encourage us to wince, too, at the very idea of labelling them Catholic schoolgirls at all. Loyalists, as I pointed out in Chapter 1, is the mealy-mouthed Northern Ireland euphemism for Protestants, just as nationalists is the euphemism for Catholics. People who do not hesitate to brand children Catholics or Protestants stop short of applying those same religious labels, far more appropriately, to adult terrorists and mobs.
Our society, including the non-religious sector, has accepted the preposterous idea that it is normal and right to indoctrinate tiny children in the religion of their parents and to slap religious labels on them. Catholic child, Protestant child, Jewish child, Muslim child, etc. Although no other comparable labels. No conservative children, no liberal children, no Republican children, no Democrat children. Please, please raise your consciousness about this and raise the roof whenever you hear it happening. A child is not a Christian child, not a Muslim child, but a child of Christian parents or a child of Muslim parents. This latter nomenclature, by the way, would be an excellent piece of consciousness raising for the children themselves. A child who is told she is a child of Muslim parents will immediately realize that religion is something for her to choose or reject when she becomes old enough to do so.
A good case can indeed be made for the educational benefits of teaching comparative religion. Certainly my own doubts were first aroused at the age of about 9 by the lesson, which came not from school but from my parents, that the Christian religion in which I was brought up was only one of many mutually incompatible belief systems. Religious apologists themselves realize this, and it often frightens them. After that nativity play story in The Independent, not a single letter to the editor complained of the religious labelling of the four-year-olds. The only negative letter came from the Campaign for Real Education, whose spokesman, Nick Seaton, said multi-faith religious education was extremely dangerous because
children these days are taught that all religions are of equal worth, which means that their own has no special value.
Yes, indeed, that is exactly what it means. Well might this spokesman worry. On another occasion, the same individual said,
"To present all faiths as equally valid is wrong. Everybody is entitled to think their faith is superior to others, be they Hindus, Jews, Muslims or Christians. Otherwise, what's the point in having faith?"
What indeed? And what transparent nonsense this is. These faiths are mutually incompatible. Otherwise, what is the point of thinking your faith superior? Most of them, therefore, cannot be superior to others. Let children learn about different faiths. Let them notice their incompatibility and let them draw their own conclusions about the consequences of that incompatibility. As for whether any are valid, let them make up their own minds when they are old enough to do so. Religious education as a part of literary culture. I must admit that even I am a little taken aback at the biblical ignorance commonly displayed by people educated in more recent decades than I was. Or maybe it isn't a decade thing. As long ago as 1954, according to Robert Hind in his thoughtful book, Why Gods Persist, a Gallup poll in the United States of America found the following. 3/4 of Catholics and Protestants could not name a single Old Testament prophet. More than 2/3 didn't know who preached the Sermon on the Mount. A substantial number thought that Moses was one of Jesus's 12 apostles. That, to repeat, was in the United States, which is dramatically more religious than other parts of the developed world. The King James Bible of 1611, the authorized version, includes passages of outstanding literary merit in its own right, for example, the Song of Songs and the sublime Ecclesiastes, which I am told is pretty good in the original Hebrew too. But the main reason the English Bible needs to be part of our education is that it is a major sourcebook for literary culture. The same applies to the legends of the Greek and Roman gods, and we learn about them without being asked to believe in them. Here is a quick list of biblical or Bible-inspired phrases and sentences that occur commonly in literary or conversational English, from great poetry to hackneyed cliché, from proverb to gossip.
Be fruitful and multiply.
East of Eden.
Adam's rib.
Am I my brother's keeper?
The mark of Cain.
As old as Methuselah.
A mess of pottage.
Sold his birthright.
Jacob's ladder.
Coat of many colours.
Amid the alien corn.
Eyeless in Gaza.
The fat of the land.
The fatted calf.
Stranger in a strange land.
Burning bush.
A land flowing with milk and honey.
Let my people go.
Flesh pots.
An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth.
Be sure your sin will find you out.
The apple of his eye.
Stars in their courses.
Butter in a lordly dish.
The hosts of Midian.
Shibboleth.
Out of the strong came forth sweetness.
He smote them hip and thigh.
Philistine.
A man after his own heart.
Like David and Jonathan.
Passing the love of women.
How are the mighty fallen.
You lamb.
Man of Belial.
Jezebel.
Queen of Sheba.
Wisdom of Solomon.
The half was not told me.
Girded up his loins.
Drew a bow at a venture.
Job's comforters.
The patience of Job.
I am escaped with the skin of my teeth.
The price of wisdom is above rubies.
Leviathan.
Go to the ant, thou sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise.
Spare the rod and spoil the child.
A word in season.
Vanity of vanities.
To everything there is a season and a time to every purpose.
The race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong.
Of making many books there is no end.
I am the rose of Sharon.
A garden enclosed.
The little foxes.
Many waters cannot quench love.
Beat their swords into plowshares.
Grind the faces of the poor.
The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid.
Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we shall die.
Set thine house in order.
A voice crying in the wilderness.
No peace for the wicked.
See eye to eye.
Cut off out of the land of the living.
Balm in Gilead.
Can the leopard change his spots?
The parting of the ways.
A Daniel in the lion's den.
They have sown the wind and they shall reap the whirlwind.
Sodom and Gomorrah.
Man shall not live by bread alone.
Get thee behind me, Satan.
The salt of the earth.
Hide your light under a bushel.
Turn the other cheek.
Go the extra mile.
Moth and rust doth corrupt.
Cast your pearls before swine.
Wolf in sheep's clothing.
Weeping and gnashing of teeth.
Gadarene swine.
New wine in old bottles.
Shake off the dust of your feet.
He that is not with me is against me.
Judgment of Solomon.
Fell upon stony ground.
A prophet is not without honour, save in his own country.
The crumbs from the table.
Sign of the times.
Den of thieves.
Pharisee.
Whited sepulchre.
Wars and rumours of wars.
Good and faithful servant.
Separate the sheep from the goats.
I wash my hands of it.
The Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath.
Suffer the little children.
The widow's mite.
Physician, heal thyself.
Good Samaritan.
Passed by on the other side.
Grapes of wrath.
Lost sheep.
Prodigal son.
A great gulf fixed.
Whose shoe latchet I am not worthy to unloose.
Cast the first stone.
Jesus wept.
Greater love hath no man than this.
Doubting Thomas.
Rode to Damascus.
A law unto himself.
Through a glass darkly.
Death, where is thy sting?
A thorn in the flesh.
Fallen from grace.
Filthy lucre.
The root of all evil.
Fight the good fight.
All flesh is as grass.
The weaker vessel.
I am Alpha and Omega.
Armageddon.
De profundis.
Quo vadis.
Rain on the just and on the unjust.
Every one of these idioms, phrases or clichés comes directly from the King James authorized version of the Bible. Surely ignorance of the Bible is bound to impoverish one's appreciation of English literature. And not just solemn and serious literature. The following rhyme by Lord Justice Bowen is ingeniously witty.
The rain it raineth on the just, and also on the unjust, fella. but chiefly on the just, because the unjust hath the just's umbrella.
But the enjoyment is muffled if you can't take the allusion to Matthew 5:45.
For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust.
And the fine point of Eliza Doolittle's fantasy in My Fair Lady would escape anybody ignorant of John the Baptist's end.
Thanks a lot, King, says I, in a manner well-bred, but all I want is Henry Higgins' Ed.
P.G. Woodhouse is, for my money, the greatest writer of light comedy in English, and I bet fully half my list of biblical phrases will be found as allusions within his pages. A Google search will not find all of them, however. It will miss the derivation of the short story title, The Aunt and the Sluggard, from Proverbs 6:6. The Woodhouse canon is rich in other biblical phrases not in my list above and not incorporated into the language as idioms or proverbs. Listen to Bertie Wooster's evocation of what it is like to wake up with a bad hangover.
I'd been dreaming that some bounder was driving spikes through my head, not just ordinary spikes as used by Jael, the wife of Heber, but red-hot ones.
Bertie himself was immensely proud of his only scholastic achievement, the prize he once earned for scripture knowledge.
What is true of comic writing in English is more obviously true of serious literature. Nasib Shaheen's tally of more than 1,300 biblical references in Shakespeare's works is widely cited and very believable. The Bible Literacy Report, published in Fairfax, Virginia, admittedly financed by the infamous Templeton Foundation, provides many examples and cites overwhelming agreement by teachers of English literature that biblical literacy is essential to full appreciation of their subject. Doubtless the equivalent is true of French, German, Russian, Italian, Spanish, and other great European literatures. And for speakers of Arabic and Indian languages, knowledge of the Quran or the Bhagavad Gita is presumably just as essential for full appreciation of their literary heritage. Finally, to round off the list, you can't appreciate Wagner, whose music, as has been wittily said, is better than it sounds, without knowing your way around the Norse gods.
Let me not labour the point. I've probably said enough to convince at least my older readers that an atheistic worldview provides no justification for cutting the Bible and other sacred books out of our education. And of course we can retain a sentimental loyalty to the cultural and literary traditions of, say, Judaism, Anglicanism, or Islam, and even participate in religious rituals such as marriages and funerals, without buying into the supernatural beliefs that historically went along with those traditions. We can give up belief in God while not losing touch with a treasured heritage. Chapter 10. A Much-Needed Gap.
What can be more soul-shaking than peering through a 100-inch telescope at a distant galaxy, holding a 100-million-year-old fossil or a 500,000-year-old stone tool in one's hand, standing before the immense chasm of space and time that is the Grand Canyon, or listening to a scientist who gazed upon the face of the universe's creation and did not blink? That is deep and sacred science. Michael Shermer.
This book fills a much-needed gap. The jest works because we simultaneously understand the two opposite meanings. Incidentally, I thought it was an invented witticism, but to my surprise, I find that it has actually been used in all innocence by a publisher whose website advertises a book that fills a much-needed gap in the literature available on the post-structuralist movement. It seems deliciously appropriate that this avowedly superfluous book is all about Michel Foucault, Roland Barthes, Julia Kristeva, and other icons of haute francophonism.
Does religion fill a much-needed gap? It is often said that there is a God-shaped gap in the brain which needs to be filled. We have a psychological need for God, imaginary friend, father, big brother, confessor, confidant, and the need has to be satisfied whether God really exists or not. But could it be that God clutters up a gap that we'd be better off filling with something else? Science, perhaps, art, human friendship, humanism, love of this life in the real world, giving no credence to other lives beyond the grave, a love of nature, or what the great entomologist E.O. Wilson has called biophilia.
Religion has at one time or another been thought to fill four main roles in human life: explanation, exhortation, consolation, and inspiration. Historically, religion aspired to explain our own existence and the nature of the universe in which we find ourselves. In this role, it is now completely superseded by science, and I've dealt with it in Chapter 4. By exhortation, I mean moral instruction on how we ought to behave, and I covered that in Chapters 6 and 7. I've not so far done justice to consolation and inspiration, and this final chapter will briefly deal with them. As a preliminary to consolation itself, I want to begin with the childhood phenomenon of the imaginary friend, which I believe has affinities with religious belief. Binker. Christopher Robin, I presume, did not believe that Piglet and Winnie the Pooh really spoke to him. But was Binker different?
Binker, what I call him, is a secret of my own, and Binker is the reason why I never feel alone. Playing in the nursery, sitting on the stair, whatever I'm busy at, Binker will be there. Oh, Daddy is clever. He's a clever sort of man, and Mummy is the best since the world began, and Nanny is Nanny, and I call her Nan. But they can't see Binker. Binker's always talking, because I'm teaching him to speak. He sometimes likes to do it in a funny sort of squeak, and he sometimes likes to do it in a hoodling sort of roar. And I have to do it for him, because his throat is rather sore. Oh, Daddy is clever. He's a clever sort of man. And Mummy knows all that anybody can, and Nanny is Nanny, and I call her Nan. But they don't know Binker. Binker's brave as lions when we're running in the park. Binker's brave as tigers when we're lying in the dark. Binker's brave as elephants. He never, never cries, except like other people when the soap gets in his eyes. Oh, Daddy is Daddy. He's a Daddy's sort of man, and Mummy is as Mummy as anybody can, and Nanny is Nanny, and I call her Nan, but they're not like Binker. Binker isn't greedy, but he does like things to eat, so I have to say to people when they're giving me a sweet, "Oh, Binker wants a chocolate, so could you give me two?" And then I eat it for him, because his teeth are rather new. Well, I'm very fond of Daddy, but he hasn't time to play. And I'm very fond of Mummy, but she sometimes goes away, and I'm often cross with Nanny when she wants to brush my hair. But Binker's always Binker, and is certain to be there. A.A. Milne, Now We Are Six.
Is the imaginary friend phenomenon a higher illusion in a different category from ordinary childhood make-believe? My own experience is not much help here. Like many parents, my mother kept a notebook of my childish sayings. In addition to simple pretendings, "Now I'm the man in the moon," "an accelerator," "a Babylonian," I was evidently fond of second-order pretendings, "Now I'm an owl pretending to be a water wheel," which might be reflexive, "Now I'm a little boy pretending to be Richard." I never once believed I really was any of those things, and I think that is normally true of childhood make-believe games. But I didn't have a Binker. If the testimony of their adult selves is to be believed, at least some of those normal children who have imaginary friends really do believe they exist, and in some cases see them as clear and vivid hallucinations. I suspect that the Binker phenomenon of childhood may be a good model for understanding theistic belief in adults. I do not know whether psychologists have studied it from this point of view, but it would be a worthwhile piece of research. Companion and confidant, a Binker for life, that is surely one role that God plays, one gap that might be left if God were to go. Another child, a girl, had a little purple man who seemed to her a real and visible presence, and would manifest himself, sparkling out of the air, with a gentle tinkling sound. He visited her regularly, especially when she felt lonely, but with decreasing frequency as she grew older. On a particular day, just before she went to kindergarten, the little purple man came to her, heralded by his usual tinkling fanfare, and announced that he would not be visiting her any more. This saddened her, but the little purple man told her that she was getting bigger now and wouldn't need him in the future. He must leave her now so that he could look after other children. He promised her that he would come back to her if she ever really needed him. He did return to her many years later in a dream, when she had a personal crisis and was trying to decide what to do with her life. The door of her bedroom opened, and a cartload of books appeared, pushed into the room by the little purple man. She interpreted this as advice that she should go to university, advice that she took and later judged to be good. The story makes me almost tearful, and it brings me as close as I shall probably come to understanding the consoling and counseling role of imaginary gods in people's lives. A being may exist only in the imagination, yet still seem completely real to the child, and still give real comfort and good advice. Perhaps even better, imaginary friends and imaginary gods have the time and patience to devote all their attention to the sufferer. And they are much cheaper than psychiatrists or professional counsellors.
Did gods, in their role as consolers and counsellors, evolve from thinkers by a sort of psychological pedomorphosis? Pedomorphosis is the retention into adulthood of childhood characteristics. Pekingese dogs have pedomorphic faces. The adults look like puppies. It is a well-known pattern in evolution, widely accepted as important for the development of such human characteristics as our bulbous forehead and short jaws. Evolutionists have described us as juvenile apes, and it is certainly true that juvenile chimpanzees and gorillas look more like humans than adult ones do. Could religions have evolved originally by gradual postponement over generations of the moment in life when children gave up their binkers, just as we slowed down during evolution the flattening of our foreheads and the protrusion of our jaws?
I suppose for completeness we should consider the reverse possibility. Rather than gods evolving from ancestral binkers, could binkers have evolved from ancestral gods? This seems to me less likely. I was led to think about it while reading the American psychologist Julian James's The Origin of Consciousness in the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind, a book that is as strange as its title suggests. It is one of those books that is either complete rubbish or a work of consummate genius, nothing in between. Probably the former, but I'm hedging my bets.
James notes that many people perceive their own thought processes as a kind of dialogue between the self and another internal protagonist inside the head. Nowadays we understand that both voices are our own, or if we don't, we're treated as mentally ill. This happened briefly to Evelyn Waugh. Never one to mince words, Waugh remarked to a friend,
"I haven't seen you for a long time, but then I've seen so few people because, did you know, I went mad."
After his recovery, Waugh wrote a novel, The Ordeal of Gilbert Pinfold, which described his hallucinatory period and the voices that he'd heard. James's suggestion is that sometime before 1000 BC, people in general were unaware that the second voice, the Gilbert Pinfold voice, came from within themselves. They thought the Pinfold voice was a god, Apollo, say, or Astarte, or Yahweh, or more probably a minor household god, offering them advice or orders. James even located the voices of the gods in the opposite hemisphere of the brain from the one that controls audible speech. The breakdown of the bicameral mind was, for James, a historical transition. It was the moment in history when it dawned on people that the external voices that they seemed to be hearing were really internal. James even goes so far as to define this historical transition as the dawning of human consciousness. There is an ancient Egyptian inscription about the creator god Ptah, which describes the various other gods as variations of Ptah's voice, or tongue. Modern translations reject the literal voice and interpret the other gods as objectified conceptions of Ptah's mind. James dismisses such educated readings, preferring to take the literal meaning seriously. The gods were hallucinated voices speaking inside people's heads. James further suggests that such gods evolved from memories of dead kings, who still, in a manner of speaking, retained control over their subjects via imagined voices in their heads. Whether or not you find his thesis plausible, James's book is intriguing enough to earn its mention in a book on religion.
Now to the possibility I raised of borrowing from James to construct a theory that gods and binkers are developmentally related, but the opposite way around from the pedomorphosis theory. It amounts to the suggestion that the breakdown of the bicameral mind didn't happen suddenly in history, but was a progressive pulling back into childhood of the moment when hallucinated voices and apparitions were rumbled as not real. In a kind of reversal of the pedomorphosis hypothesis, the hallucinated gods disappeared from adult minds first, then were pulled back earlier and earlier into childhood, until today they survive only in the Binker, or Little Purple Man phenomenon. The problem with this version of the theory is that it doesn't explain the persistence of gods into adulthood today.
It might be better not to treat gods as ancestral to Binkers or vice versa, but rather to see both as byproducts of the same psychological predisposition. Gods and Binkers have in common the power to comfort and provide a vivid sounding board for trying out ideas. We have not moved far from Chapter 5, Psychological Byproduct Theory of the Evolution of Religion. Consolation. It is time to face up to the important role that God plays in consoling us, and the humanitarian challenge, if he does not exist, to put something in his place. Many people who concede that God probably doesn't exist, and that he is not necessary for morality, still come back with what they often regard as a trump card, the alleged psychological or emotional need for a god. If you take religion away, people truculently ask, what are you going to put in its place? What have you to offer the dying patients, the weeping bereaved, the lonely Eleanor Rigbys, for whom God is their only friend?
The first thing to say in response to this is something that should need no saying. Religion's power to console doesn't make it true. Even if we make a huge concession, even if it were conclusively demonstrated that belief in God's existence is completely essential to human psychological and emotional well-being, even if all atheists were despairing neurotics driven to suicide by relentless cosmic angst, none of this would contribute the tiniest jot or tittle of evidence that religious belief is true. It might be evidence in favour of the desirability of convincing yourself that God exists, even if he doesn't. As I've already mentioned, Dennett, in Breaking the Spell, makes the distinction between belief in God and belief in belief, the belief that it is desirable to believe, even if the belief itself is false. Lord, I believe, help thou mine unbelief. Mark 9:24. The faithful are encouraged to profess belief, whether they are convinced by it or not. Maybe if you repeat something often enough, you will succeed in convincing yourself of its truth. I think we all know people who enjoy the idea of religious faith and resent attacks on it, while reluctantly admitting that they don't have it themselves. Since reading of Dennett's distinction, I found occasion to use it again and again. It is scarcely an exaggeration to say that the majority of atheists I know disguise their atheism behind a pious facade. They do not believe in anything supernatural themselves, but retain a vague soft spot for irrational belief. They believe in belief. It is amazing how many people seemingly cannot tell the difference between X is true and it is desirable that people should believe that X is true. Or maybe they don't really fall for this logical error, but simply rate truth as unimportant compared with human feelings. I don't want to decry human feelings, but let's be clear in any particular conversation what we're talking about, feelings or truth. Both may be important, but they're not the same thing. In any case, my hypothetical concession was extravagant and wrong. I know of no evidence that atheists have any general tendency towards unhappy, angst-ridden despond. Some atheists are happy, others are miserable. Similarly, some Christians, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, and Buddhists are miserable, while others are happy. There may be statistical evidence bearing on the relationship between happiness and belief, or unbelief, but I doubt if it is a strong effect one way or the other. I find it more interesting to ask whether there is any good reason to feel depressed if we live without God. I shall end this book by arguing, on the contrary, that it is an understatement to say that one can lead a happy and fulfilled life without supernatural religion. First, though, I must examine the claims of religion to offer consolation. Consolation, according to the Shorter Oxford Dictionary, is the alleviation of sorrow or mental distress. I shall divide consolation into two types.
1. Direct physical consolation. A man stuck for the night on a bare mountain may find comfort in a large, warm St. Bernard dog, not forgetting, of course, the brandy barrel around its neck. A weeping child may be consoled by the embrace of strong arms wrapped around her and reassuring words whispered in her ear. 2. Consolation by discovery of a previously unappreciated fact or a previously undiscovered way of looking at existing facts. A woman whose husband has been killed in war may be consoled